The Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by Hippo Camp 2018. Now in its fourth year, Hippo Camp is a three-day Pennsylvania writing conference that features 50-plus speakers, engaging sessions and four tracks, interactive all-conference panels, author and attendee readings, social activities, networking ops, and optional intimate pre-conference workshops. The conference takes place in lovely Lancaster from August 24th through August 26th. Past keynotes have been Lee Gutkind, Mary Carr, Dinty W. Moore, and Jane Friedman. All have been past guests on the podcast. This year, Abigail Thomas will be the featured speaker. Visit hippocampusmagazine.com and click the conference tab in the toolbar. And if you enter the keyword CNFPOD, at checkout, you will receive a $50 discount. This offer is only good through August 10th or until all those tickets are sold. There are a limited number, so act now, like right now. The registration is $429 otherwise, $379 with the discount, through August 10th, then goes up to $449 on site. So if you sign up through the portal before the conference starts, you're actually saving $70. Hippo Camp 2018. Create, share, live. Woo! You ready? Let's hit it. And away we go. It's a creative nonfiction podcast, people. It's the show where I speak to the best artists about telling true stories. I'm your host, Brendan O'Mara. Hey. For episode 106, I welcome Rebecca Fish Ewan, author of By the Forces of Gravity, books by Hippocampus 2018, a love story between friends that ends in tragedy, told through free verse poetry and cartoons. It's a great reading experience and a wonderfully told story of adolescence in the 1970s Berkeley scene. You can buy the book by visiting books.hippocampusmagazine.com or via Amazon. In this episode, we dig into how Rebecca chose to write the story in the way she did, the power of community, writing from the point of view of her 12-year-old self, and dealing with self-doubt. Haven't been there before. Rebecca is at rfishewan, so that's R-F-I-S-H. E-W-A-N on Instagram, her preferred social network, and is the same handle on Facebook. Go check her out. If you're not subscribed to the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, this very show, be sure to hit up Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and Stitcher so you get a fresh delivery every Friday. Share this with the people you think that'll dig it, and let me know what you think of it, what you got out of it. I'm at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod on Twitter and at CNFPodcast on Facebook. Pick a network, any network, and let's connect. Now, it's time for the show. Well, what's that process like of going back and forth with an editor over Skype to hone a manuscript?
It's been pretty interesting because we also... Don is super organized. You probably have noticed this.
Yeah, for sure.
Which I greatly appreciate. And so she set up a whole bunch of Google Docs so that like when I had my drawings done and organized, I just uploaded them into the Google Doc, and then she could share those with the book designer. And there was the book cover designer as well. So everything was done, all of the transactions, other than the first time I met her, which was at a conference in Reykjavik, which was awesome.
Yeah. Wow.
Like that was right when and we had the conversation about whether or not I would want to have my book published through Hippocampus. And so that was really cool to meet her. And so having Skype, it was nice to be able to check in every once in a while, face to face. Yeah. And we made a made a book together.
Yeah.
That way.
When you guys were at that conference in Iceland, what was the conversations you were having? Because this is their first book, Donna's first book through her imprint. So how did the conversation come about, and what were those early visions and discussions like?
I had actually, the very first time I saw her or heard her speak, I was looking for someone that I could send a small press that I could send my book to, or send a query letter to get published. And it's a very kind of odd form, because it's a story told in cartoons and poetry.
Yeah.
And kind of unusual. And so a lot of the small presses would say, you know, they just have on their website, no poetry, you know, because they just don't take those submissions. And so, publishers of graphic novels are pretty exclusive to graphic novels, and mine is a hybrid. And I found one night, it was like midnight, you know, searching the internet, I found a YouTube video of her announcing that they're going to start, Hippocampus was going to start a book imprint. And it's all based, I mean, Hippocampus is all based on memory, writing from memory. And so I was like, well, they'll be open-minded. That's what I was. That was the feeling I got from just listening to her talk, is that they'll be open to a really odd little form that I had created to tell the story. And so, you know, when we finally met, and it was just sort of a coincidence, I was going to Nonfiction Now in Reykjavik, and she had also registered to go, and I was on a panel there. And we didn't know each other was going until right before we left, and we arranged to meet for the first time at the conference.
And the form of the book, as you were saying, it's half prose poem and half cartoons. And so how did you come to the form? How did you come to want to tell this particular story this particular way?
Through struggle. I tried to do it in the what I kind of consider the sort of straight narrative form of memoir, where you're an adult remembering a period of your life and you're crafting it through your retrospect, that you craft the story and you tell the story that way. And that works with some stories, but it just was not working for me it was 1970s. I was 12 years old. It was in Berkeley, and it was just a time that's hard to reflect on without like focusing on the copious amounts of drugs people were using, this whole free love sex that was fairly rampant, and without it sounding judgmental or almost caricature-ish. If you see like TV or movies about the 70s, everything seems almost cartoonish in the way that it's described. And it just wasn't working. And so then I tried to fictionalize it, and I made these stories, which I love, this little book series that I came up with. I wrote all these manuscripts that are yet to be published, but I learned a lot about storytelling, about the use of dialogue, about just crafting a story through this. But it didn't end up telling the story, because what I discovered about fiction is you create characters, and then the characters have a mind of their own and they go and do stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
they just do other things. And so I created all of these characters that told a different story. They told a story about what they wanted to, what they were doing. And it's, I know there's this, I just read about this genre called, it's like auto fiction or something that's supposed to be basically, I don't know, it feels like kind of like hidden memoir, where you fictionalize memoir. But I mean, I think maybe all fiction is kind of that way, somewhat from your human experience. Mm-hmm. So some of the emotional parts of the story were there, but it was just so different that it wasn't telling the story. And so, I remember my son was about 12 at the time, which was the age I was when this story begins. And he was sitting on the couch, and he he was very tiny when he was 12. He's big, gangly, almost 17-year-old teenager now, but he was really small. And I realized that that was the person who needed to tell the story, this 12-year-old, this tiny kind of waif-like hippie girl who was living in, you know, who moved into a commune that was just for kids and had this experience and had this friend and made this friendship that was like no other friendship I've ever had. And she doesn't know her best friend is going to die. She doesn't know that.
Right.
How could I know that? And that was the important thing, because as a grown-up, I couldn't forget that fact. I mean, it's a devastating fact to have your best friend die. And so I couldn't, as an adult, get past the story of how her life ended. And I wanted to tell the story of how her life was lived. Mm. And so I realized I have to tell it in first person present. And that's where the poetry came in, because I was, you know, 12. I didn't know anything about grammar. I had dropped out of, you know, elementary school. And so it just came out. So I don't actually call it prose poetry as much. It's narrative poetry, but in prose, they, you know, they have sentences and paragraphs and commas. Yeah. I don't have any of those things. And so free verse is more how I think about it. It allowed for a very quick pace. It allowed for a lot of the fun things that happen with language in poetry that I think is closer to spoken word, that was much truer to her voice.
The poetry, the way you're able to digest that allows you to then enjoy the images as well. Like, you don't get exhausted reading the poetry part so much so that you're not able to ingest and digest the accompanying cartoon part as well. If it were just prose, it might get exhausting to have to read that and then see the
picture.
Too
many words.
Yeah.
that's exactly, that was exactly what happened. And so I had these poems, and once I found that voice, the poems were just like, I had scraps of paper. They were just kind of spilling out of me. And the story just, it came much easier, but not until I had struggled trying to make it in fiction, years of trying to tell the story in a way that wasn't working before. Once it was working, it came very quickly. And I printed all of those, and I had them in a binder, and I started drawing on them because I was trying to revise the words. I was trying to create sort of the context and the images. I was trying to see the scenes. And I just started drawing on the drafts. And eventually they became an important part of the actual storytelling. And I was like, well, this is a way I can show things to people that maybe I don't even know. So sometimes there's a couple of places where the drawings reveal things that I can't see as the character, as the, but they also, sometimes they do, offer kind of a different perspective. And sometimes they're just to add a little levity when things are, particularly not funny. Mm. Like in the chapter on dark matter, you know, a lot of the things that were happening to me, it's not funny. It's not, being sexually abused as a child is not funny.
Right.
But it wasn't 100% just this dark and terrible moment. And so I tried to, and plus when someone's reading about it, that's a hard thing to read about. And I wanted to kind of have the sometimes I think the cartoons offer a way to buoy people up as they're moving through some of the moments.
And what was it in your earliest recollection about Luna that you were so drawn to?
I mean, I think it really was like the second I met her, she was just this shining light of a person, which is so different from me. I think she was so opposite who I was, but she wanted to talk to me. She hung out with me. We became like inseparable best friends. And it was so it was just to be near her. And she was always positive about everything. And she always had this like really profound explanation for everything. And it was like making reality magical. And I've said that before, that like in terms of the book, sometimes it's a little bit like magical realism, but it was like just realism for her. Mm-hmm. Just everything had the potential to be magic. And it was kind of intoxicating to be around her, intimidating, you know, and complex. And I wasn't really, you know, that good at it. I don't know that I was the best friend, but she was awesome. It was a wonderful time for me, but then it ended so darkly that I just packed it up in a box and stuck it into the dark recesses of my mind and, you know, my heart. And I think I needed a lot of time to pass before I could turn it into something that I could share with people. Because that's a question that comes up a lot with memoirs. Like, why do you have to tell that story? That's a terrible story. Hmm. But I don't see it that way. I see it as an opportunity to tell a different story. Yeah. If you Google her name and you look for any information about her, it's usually just a couple of sentences. And most of them say she was the, you know, the 15-year-old daughter of Robert Anton Wilson, who was murdered. And that's a terrible legacy to leave when you were an amazing person when you were alive. And that was the main reason that I wanted to share the story. I mean, I wanted to tell the story and kind of work it through for myself, but I wanted to share the story because I think people should be remembered how they lived their lives and not how they left it.
Mm. And given that this took place decades ago, was this always something that you wanted to process through a story of this nature, or were you, or how long did you feel like you had to wait in order for you to be able to process it and tell the story adequately?
I think sometimes you don't really know when the good time is. You just keep trying. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, that's not working, or I'm not ready. I mean, in my 20s, it would have been a terrible story because I would have just focused on the end and right. It would have been dark. And it was also going to be about this terrible thing that happened to me. And it's like, the terrible thing didn't happen to me. The terrible thing happened to Luna.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, witness to that moment, and it was devastating, but I'm alive. Being able to get past that. And then I also think I hung on to a lot of stuff. I still have the poetry book I made for her. I have my high school notes. A lot of the things, some of the poems actually are verbatim taken from my high school notes. And so I squirreled that stuff away, not really knowing why, but it was sort of like remnants of a memory of a time and a person that was no longer there. And so I kept that stuff. And so I had it to refer to. Most of the drawings are, a lot of the drawings are of actual things I'm looking at, like the last gift she gave me. Those kinds of things are all things I have in my closet, in my writing room. And so I had those things for a reason, but I just really didn't know exactly what it was. And then the other thing is technology. I could Google all of these things that were really important, like the weather on any day in Berkeley. Hmm. And I don't know if people know this, but all you have to do is Google weather history, and you can find out what the visibility was on any given day, when it snowed, who was playing at Winterland, what songs they played, every single concert. There's people out there that put this stuff on the internet. I don't know why they do, but I love them for it. And it was really helpful because I would have memories of, like, I know I listened to this song, and then I could just find out when it was released. And then I would write that down on my calendar. I would know I went to a certain concert or a certain place, or that I played in the snow. And then I could find that information, those facts of those things I found on the internet, and I would put them in a calendar, and I kind of created anchors for the story that were based on reality. So,
yeah. And do you recall a particular moment that crystallized in you that you were ready to take on the story and tell it in the way that you wanted to?
One of the things, I still have the query letter that I wrote to Donna, and I think it's just, I mean, that's one of those kind of perfect storm moments. She just, I mean, there was a lot of preparation and thinking and planning that went into her deciding to start publishing books, years of preparation for that. And there was also years of me writing really terrible query letters and not really knowing what I was doing in preparation for writing the letter to her, because I've kept that. And that's a pretty good query letter. I finally figured out how to say exactly what I wanted to say about why this is an important story and it's worthy of publication. So there was sort of that moment when I could finally craft the query letter right. I think that in terms of thinking of it as, like, seriously thinking of it as a book, I mean, I workshopped it through Literary Kitchen with Ariel Gore. She has a summer manuscript workshop, and I workshopped the manuscript after I had a full draft with the cartoons and I had the form figured out. And so that was, I mean, I was really thinking of it as something that I definitely wanted to publish. Another moment, I had gone to a Poets and Writers conference. They had Poets and Writers Live, and they would go to a city, and they went to San Francisco, and they had this one-day conference, and the theme was inspiration. And one of the, actually most of the speakers, there was sort of this mantra that, I mean, I don't think they like got together and said, hey, let's tell them you need to be a part of an active part of a literary community. Hey, let's tell them, you know, these things. It's just a truth that I heard that day that, you know, you don't go to a conference because you want to find an agent and get your thing published. That, and it's not all about you and your book. It's about building a community and being a part of that community. And if you open yourself up, and this is exactly the kind of stuff Luna used to tell me all the time about, you know, karma and good vibes and all of this stuff, that if you it's like improv, you know, if you just always walk in and say yes, that good things will happen. And that is precisely what happened. It was after that conference, I started making zines and getting more involved with the zine community in Phoenix, and just trying to be a contribution to the literary community rather than being me alone in my room writing my book and wondering why nobody appreciates it.
Yeah, that's so important what you're saying right now.
And it really worked. I mean, it's like that whole positive karma thing. And then, you know, and then Donna wanted to published the book, and I was like over the moon. It was fantastic. And it's been perfect because it's a new thing. They had the anthology so that she could kind of, in a controlled way, figure out how to make books and how her book's different than an online magazine. But like working with an author and the contract and all of these things, there's so much transparency. For me, it was really awesome. Because I like that. I had, she made the book precisely as I imagined it, and then better.
And what was the difficulty in telling the story through your 12, you know, to 14-ish year, you know, 12-year-old eyes, and not imbue it with the decades of experience that came after? Like, how did you stay really grounded in that time?
Well, there's probably the previous struggle of having tried it and knowing that voice wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. And I think the form, the maturity and experience that I have, because I've been through an MFA program in creative writing and poetry. I have a lot of training in writing. So I was able to tinker, I guess, as a grown-up with the words, with the language, so that I wouldn't interfere so much with what the action, I guess. So I could be there as, you know, thinking about, oh, well, should this be, this word be here? Where's the line break going to go? And what's the flow of all of this? These are all things that a mature mind, you know, likes to think about and do. So I wouldn't interfere so much in the action of the story. In that way, I tried to just tell it as I remembered it. Except the part is that I was relatively quiet. And so a lot of the story is what was going on in my head while these things are happening. And that's probably the newer part that anybody that went through that with me didn't see as much. And I tried not to be too smart about the personal interactions that I was having.
Hmm. As you were crafting this book and you found the way you wanted to tell it, it finally crystallized, like, all right, it's going to be free verse with these cartoons, and you've got the playbook with you. What was your sort of routine around that? And how were you setting up your days and checking in with yourself so you could have a very productive day with the generative phase of this book?
That's also a very good question, because there's that sort of idea that, you know, to be a real writer, you have to have a 6-hour chunk of time, or you have to do 3 hours of writing every day at the same time, or some kind of structure. But I'm a mom. I have a full-time job as a professor. I have a house, and, you know, I have stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And I had cobbled together, especially when my kids were young, when they're really little, you know, they just have needs and they're immediate, and you need, you know, you're their parent. You can't just go, no, I'm having my literary hours now. Go feed yourself. I can't do that. And so I was already practiced at, I keep my notebook with me wherever I go, and I always have something to write with. And that if a poem came to me while I was driving or parked at the Safeway or whatever, wherever it came, I would write it down. So I had already cultivated, and maybe that's why I chose poetry rather than prose, because, you know, a poem can sometimes in its rough draft form spill out very quickly. What I think I don't know if a lot of people, if you don't write poetry, think that that's it. That's all you do. There's a lot of poems are multiple revisions.
Mm-hmm.
Where the really, you know, harder work of poetry, I think, is in the revisions. And so I had a print copy of it that I would just constantly, I read it out loud. I don't know how many times, many, many times. I read everything I write pretty much out loud before, just because, to get the cadence of it, to get the voice right, to get the words right. If I'm stumbling over words, maybe those aren't the right words. That just became part of my routine, that I would, whenever I had moments alone. And then I did finally, we bought a bigger house and I got a writing room, and I have a drawing table. So that was part of the ability to be able to draw all those cartoons, is that I had a light table, I had a space to do that.
And are you moving between the two with a predictability? Like, you would have your poem and like, all right, now it's time to draw? Or would you sometimes go from, you would draw the cartoon and then write the poem to reflect it?
Well, by the time I had a fairly complete first draft of all of the poems, I had maybe a third of the cartoons that I had just sort of scribbled on the work or started drawing in my notebook. And so then once I cobbled it together and I realized it needs to be a paired relationship, there'd be gaps in the drawings. And so then once it gets nearer to the final revisions, I can have kind of a to-do list I need, and it was the same way with my first book, The Land Between. I had the same thing where I just, you know, once I had a draft, I would realize, oh, there's a gap of information. I got to go get that information. Oh, I need to, now when I go to the Owens Valley, I need to go and take a photograph of this barn. You know, I had kind of very specific instructions, and it was very much that way. Near the end, I would realize I need this kind of drawing to go with these. Until I had one for every page.
Yeah. And crafting any kind of memoir oftentimes is a big challenge, especially when, you know, there's, you know, a significant loss in the book. And I wonder how did you work yourself through the drafts of this book, you know, given how it ends, and how was that for you, and how did you work your way through it?
That was probably the hardest part, are the part I call the dark pages. Mm. And it's the last few chapters, which are really fast. There's not that much, many words to them. For those dark pages, I actually did those with both hands, and I had to just remember how horrible. I mean, it was really hard.
Yeah.
And I just scribbled. And then the controlled part of me as an adult creating something would be, I would stop and I would scan what I had scribbled. And then I would go back and keep scribbling it, because it was getting darker and darker. And I wanted it to, present it in the opposite. So, which is how it kind of felt, where it was like my whole entire world went black and dark. And slowly over time, light starts to kind of creep in. I don't think you get over really, really intense loss, but I do think, you know, you have the capacity to let light back into your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what those pages are doing. They're getting a little bit lighter as time goes on. And then the other thing that I did is, that's the area where I rely the most on poems constructed from my notebooks in high school, because I wanted to offer to people precisely how I was kind of seeing the world. And they're really fragmented, which I think is how you also experience really traumatic. When your whole body is traumatized, your mind is traumatized, your brain is not remembering things in the same way that it does when it, just in a normal day, where it's kind of squirreling away all this information. It's very fragmented, and I wanted to offer it that way.
Mm.
And I had to kind of slow down the pace in some of the places. So I have these little drawings of just things that I'm seeing, kind of object focused. So there's a lot of controlled construction in those last few pages, because I was thinking about the reader and how to, you know, you can't just throw that at someone and not kind of try and carry them through it in a gentler way.
In thinking about the reader, how do you create in the face of an end product or an end user and not be stifled by that?
I think that aha moment where I was thinking about, not so much focused on it's me and my story, me and my book, but a literary community or just even an artistic community, a community of people that love creative work, that I thought of them and tried to think of how to tell this story in a way that was as true to the experience. I mean, that's the idea of it. I think in fiction is like that. I think any storytelling is like that. You're trying to craft something so that while someone is, you know, sitting in their room alone, or they're sitting outside on the deck or wherever they are reading your book, they're experiencing your life for a moment, how you experienced it. That's what you're going for. And however you can do that, you know, with the skills that you have, I can draw and I can write poetry. So it's part of why it ended up that way, because that's where I have some skill. I'm hoping that when someone reads it, they, you know, clearly it's a sad story. It has some dark moments in it, but it's also was an adventure. Being Luna's friend was an amazing adventure. Being in the 70s in Berkeley was an adventure.
Yeah.
It wasn't always fun, but we got to go on road trips. We drove to Fresno to become fruit pickers during the grape strike, which is just a ridiculous thing to do. My dad would have never approved of that. He wouldn't even let me eat grapes during the strike. It was just this silly thing, but we did it. And I have the memory of it, and I wanted to share that with people. And so it kind of actually wasn't stifling. It was the enjoyable part of it, is sort of trying to imagine, okay, then they're going to, you know, have this part. Oh, it's going to get dark here. Let's have some levity, or, you know.
Who did you turn to for models and inspiration in terms of your drawing and even in your writing? Who were some of those key influences for you?
Definitely for writing, Ariel Gore is a huge influence for me. I've taken workshops with her. I've read probably all of her books, and she is a fantastic storyteller. And she tells, you know, she writes memoir, but she has a pretty broad spectrum of things she writes about. But and, you know, directly, because she workshopped the book with me. And in drawing, a lot of the people that I acknowledge in the acknowledgments, Murray Sendak was a huge influence growing up. I grew up with, you know, reading his books, and his artwork is phenomenal. And there's a number of artists, even R. Crumb. I mean, the content of his comics is pretty hard to take, but his abilities with ink pen are amazing. He's just really, really good. And so I kind of grew up with those comic books laying around the house. That's what happens when you're raised by a single dad, I guess. And so it was a kind of a combination of just looking at a lot of the artwork, and then the zine world, and what people are able to create, and you can find on the internet, or you can follow them on Instagram. They're just these amazing artists that have just wonderful skills. And so that's a lot of influence. And seeing, I think probably part of it, maybe a timing thing, that I think there's a community based on the, you know, people who support and make zines, and internet comics and comic artists and comics poetry and all of these kind of DIY world that exists today, kind of made it a good time for a book like mine to come out, I think. Because there's a receptive audience, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, making zines is pretty fun. I just started one for the podcast, just for the hell of it. And it's just like I take little snippets. I'll print out tweets from the guests, and I paste them in there and make the copies and draw thought bubbles coming out of them from quotes from their episode and all this. It is just a lot of fun, and it's better than a business card, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's very. I love zines. They're very liberating. And it's just very positive, and people are just sharing stuff, their personal experiences or what they know about growing organic carrots. It doesn't matter. So in Phoenix, there's a zine distro, Wasted Ink. And so I go to their, they have events, and they have just it's a tiny little space filled with zines. And they get zines from all over. And then they also have all of these sort of community events. So it's this world that is very community oriented, and open and positive and receptive. It's just really nice. And it's sort of like a world that's kind of got Luna's vibe. And the part about the 70s that was really wonderful, that this kind of, well, I can do that. I can do that myself. Oh, let's make this. Yeah. My dad was really into community stuff and communal living. That's why he let us live at a commune, because I think he just thought that was a cool idea as a concept. Probably if he had investigated it further, he might have had issues with some of the things that were going on there. But the idea of we were members of a food co-op, and I went and made like tons of loaves of bread, and we would go and deliver them in a big school bus. And it was just that part of it, I think, is kind of having a renaissance, but in a really kind of cool, sophisticated way. So that's been a really neat part of the zine community, and kind of the DIY and the maker community that's happening.
And when you get struck by feelings of self-doubt, as most writers and artists do, how do you approach that? What kind of self-talk do you use to kind of pull yourself back out of it so you can get back to work and actually make something worthwhile?
That's probably one where time has, you know, there's a lot of things about getting older that's not so great. Gravity.
Yes.
Constantly pulling on you and your body starts giving out. But patience is something that I didn't really ever have as a young person. I was very impatient and would get frustrated if I couldn't figure something out right away. You know, if I couldn't do a math problem, I'd hurl my book across the room. But now I'm like, I've done this kind of drawing. I know there's going to be a moment when I'm trying to draw this thing and it looks like crap, and it doesn't look like it's ever going to look anything better than crap. But I know, because I've done it so many times, that there's this sort of moment when it actually starts to look like the thing I'm trying to draw and become something. So that gives me some patience. And the same thing with writing is just, I have faith that even if I don't know where I'm going, if words pop into my head, I write them down, because one, I'm going to forget them pretty quickly these days, but also because I have faith. It's happened that many times. I'm like, something's going to come out of this. I'm just going to write it down and then I'll put it away. And, you know, my brain is just constantly sort of churning over and finding connections and looking at things around the world and, you know, seeing patterns in things. And if something occurs to it, to the point where I hear words in my head, I write them down. Doodling too is really helpful, because if words aren't coming, then I can draw. Well, and it doesn't have to be anything. It can just be, you know, whatever. To have kind of an arsenal of things that you can do when you're not sure what to do. I also, because now I'm kind of feeling like, okay, I've worked, this book has been this focus of mine for a long time, and now it's a book. You know, it's a thing. I can't revise it anymore.
Yeah.
And so I've been preparing kind of for that precipice of what now. And so every time I hear of a workshop and it sounds interesting, I sign up. I take online workshops. I'm just finishing one with Chelsea Clammer, who is Ariel Gore. I was in her book club we had a book coven for a little while. And it was one of the books that we read, and I loved it, Circadian. And I just love the writing. And so she teaches workshops. And so I've taken some of her workshops. I sign up for quite a number of workshops through the Literary Kitchen with Ariel Gore. I do writing workshops down at Wasted Ink. They offer one called Off the Page, which has an open mics part of it, which is not really what I do normally, but I like the writing part of it. So anything and I'm just squirreling all of this stuff away and drawing and just trying to draw and read as much as possible to be ready for that, not really knowing what the story is, but, you know, just so I don't have a blank slate in front of me. Yeah, and I'm not a super organized person, but I do have my notebook with me all the time, and I try and write the date down. And then if it's a book idea or a story idea, I just write, or a zine idea. I do a zine called Tiny Joys, and which I love. making those. And so if I have ideas for the next Tiny Joys, I'll write that down, and then it's all in one place, but it's really easy for me to lose them, you know, and to know like, where was that? I'm not super organized, but at least it's there in my notebook that, you know, if I'm trying to figure out ideas for a book, I've got tons of them inside that notebook.
Well, and lastly, Rebecca, where can people find you online and find out more about the book and maybe engage with you online if they want to?
Well, I have my website, RebeccaFishEwan.com.
Fantastic. And are you on like Twitter or Instagram?
Yes, I love Instagram because it's photo oriented. So I'm on that as RFishEwan, like at RFishEwan. Mm-hmm. And that's the same for Twitter, which I'm not as consistent or as comfortable with Twitter.
Fantastic. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for carving out some time to do this. And thank you for the book. It's wonderful. It's a great, it's really, to me, it's like it's a love story between friends. And I enjoyed it immensely. And I wish you continued success with it. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I'm really glad that you see it that way, because that's exactly how I wanted it to be perceived, you know, that you could kind of feel the love I had for Luna and just the love she had for life.
Sad you like that. I pulled that one in under 50 minutes. Not bad, right? I'm trying to get a little shorter with these out of respect for everyone's time. If you dig the show and you have a minute, please leave a review over on Apple Podcasts. Podcast. If you show me evidence of your review, I will edit a piece of your writing of up to 2,000 words. Also, show notes and the like are at brendanomara.com. While there, you can sign up for my monthly reading list newsletter, 4 books on what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. Once a month, no spam, can't beat that. Again, let's connect on social. I'm at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod on Twitter, and at CNF Podcast on Facebook. Let me know what's up. If I can help, I'll help. Thanks for listening. Have a CNF and great 4th of July. I'll see you right back here next week.